SCP-7341, Nothing and Everything. In the 1999 film The Matrix, the character Morpheus famously asks the character Neo, "What is real?" In the film, their discussion revolves around the separation between the real world and the virtual one that Neo had been living in for his whole life. In philosophy, however, realism is a common point of discussion, and has been for centuries. To many, if we can see it, touch it, sense it, we know that it's real, compared to something imaginary. But as Morpheus states in the film, that merely means that anything real is just electrical signals interpreted by the brain. I bring this up because SCP-7341 is, of course, about the real versus the unreal, the difference between what exists and what doesn't exist, and how humanity can impact one through the other. It's a bit of a head trip, to say the least, so let's take a look. SCP-7341 has no object class, and the always ominous description of SCP-7341 does not exist. The remainder of the article is Level 5 classified, and upon opening it, we see that it has the Esoteric Containment class and a Risk class of Critical. 7341 is currently contained by the Merkahui Containment System, located within Deepwell 354 in eastern Iceland, roughly 76 kilometers west of Research Station 211. A 5-kilometer exclusion zone has been established around the Deepwell to prevent civilian exposure to terminality bleed-through of the containment vessel. The Merkahui system is composed of 3 primary elements and a large number of supporting elements, all of which must be maintained in order to secure containment of 7341, which are powered by energy pulled from the nearby hydropower plant. The 3 primary systems that comprise Merkahui include Vitsmunir, a complex superconstructive containment algorithm and logic processor built on the Dark Mind AI platform. Capable of 2,414 petaflops, it is responsible for making the necessary adjustments to the Cormaxin Andrews field generator within the containment vessel that holds 7341. The containment vessel, Charna, is located beneath Deepwell 354, and its inner compression matrix is capable of withstanding exposure to Class 9 unreality through the use of Cormaxin Andrews field generators, known as Visca. These are a set of 484 di-reality field generators arranged within Charna and used to counteract the metastructural compulsion force generated by restricted unreality. Maintenance of Visca is the most important aspect of 7341's containment that requires direct human intervention. Each generator must undergo routine inspection and replacement, if Vitsmunir determines it. Charna is capable of maintaining containment with no fewer than 441 generators in operation. Due to a logic fault that was present within Merkahui at the moment of activation during the 7341 Delta test runs, the 7341 terminality field has extended past the boundaries of the containment vessel. This terminality bleed-through is intersecting with the Level 3 observation deck, and so no human personnel are permitted to enter either of the affected observation chambers or any of the interior structures of the containment vessel. Local space-time within the affected area is critically disrupted, outside of the region sustained by Charna, including the Visca access points. Interacting with any area of terminality bleed-through is invariably fatal, and any personnel affected by 7341's area of influence are considered lost. SCP-7341 is a static point void of non-reality, which doesn't emit or absorb light or sound, does not have shape or texture, cannot be passed through, cannot be interacted with, cannot be manipulated in any way, and has no dimension. We've seen this before, with SCP-3930, a pattern screamer. I've done a video on pattern screamers if you're interested in learning more, but essentially they are consciousnesses from a different universe that are embedded within the fabric of reality, and thus manifest in a variety of forms. Notably, however, their presence is largely based on perception, so the more people that are aware of them, the stronger they grow. Thus, with SCP-3930, only 7 people were ever allowed to be aware of its existence at one time in order to keep it contained. We're quickly informed here, though, that 7341 does not exhibit the same threats resulting from human awareness, likely due to the significantly reduced size of the void in question and the containment system around it, which does beg the question of why it's under level 5 clearance. 7341 doesn't exist. It is not a physical location, point in time, singularity, vacuum, extra-dimensional space, meta-construct, or any other extant descriptive, as a requirement for any such descriptive is existence, which it lacks. It cannot be said to be anything, regardless of its perceived properties, and as it does not exist, it cannot contain anything that exists. Due to this, anything that attempts to pass through or enter it, which is impossible due to it being non-existent, will also cease to exist. Yeah, I know, it's a bit tricky. While SCP-3930 is believed to have been a naturally occurring relativistic anomaly, 7341 was manufactured by the SCP Foundation Deepwell 354 research team on the 23rd of December 2021, during the 7341 Delta test runs. Ejection of high-energy particles through a wavepoint inhibitor focused at a point within a metaphysically stable region contained by the Cormax and Andrews field inside of the Charna containment vessel created a relativistic vacuum state that, upon repeated exposure to additional high-energy particles to further excite the wavepoint inhibitor, entered a null state that was no longer compatible with local reality. This null state rapidly dropped below the relativistic cohesion baseline and then collapsed entirely, leaving behind an absence in local space-time. That's a whole lot of big words, but basically the Foundation was trying to actually reproduce SCP-3930 in order to study it in a controlled environment. They wanted to do so because it's considered a fundamental principle within relativistic metaphysics, and a better understanding of it could provide valuable knowledge for containing and mitigating future incursions of the void into relativistic space-time. The attempt was, of course, ultimately successful, due in no small part to the work of Dr. John Cormixon and Dr. Cheryl Andrews, both of whom helped to pioneer research into supercritical relativistic field theory that allowed for a safe confinement protocol to be established for null state experimentation. Their efforts, along with significant contributions by Dr. Ivan Zatsepin and Dr. Harry Leclerc, and the implementation of the Merkahui system to manage all system-critical protocols within the containment array, led to the creation of 7341, the first known stable static point void in containment. However, an error in the system's energy allocation logic during one test did not sufficiently account for the increased metastatic load that the Visca array would experience during the initial manifestation of the point void within the containment array. The difference in the predicted load versus the real load resulted in localized bleed-through of 7341's terminality field. The field was intended to be contained entirely within the Charna vessel, but now instead extends past the confinement array and intersects with the Level 3 observation deck. The system has identified the logic error and has queued a correction, but performing that correction would require a full shutdown and restart of the containment array. This is considered unrealistic and would likely result in uncontrolled expansion of the terminal boundary until additional countermeasures against further terminality bleed-through can be installed. The point at which the field is restricted is roughly 11 meters from the back wall of the observation deck, although this border is not immediately obvious. Due to the effects of the void on human perception, individuals will perceive an approximation of what their minds expect to see past this boundary. Most affected persons will see the remainder of the observation deck as expected, and personnel working near the point of terminality bleed-through have reported additional auditory and visual hallucinations, likely due to the ongoing collapse of relativistic space-time beyond the terminal boundary. So, much like in SCP-3930, the human mind cannot comprehend the true nothingness of one of these voids, as it's not like a black hole or something where it's pitch black. It's absolutely nothing, and so our minds can't help but fill the gap in with what it expects to be there. Since anything passing through the void ceases to exist as well, that makes it pretty dangerous to work anywhere near the thing. This void was meant to be entirely contained within their system, but an error made it bleed out a bit, which is the dangerous part. It's still largely contained, as it's still restricted by the Cormaxon-Andrews field, despite the field and the generators maintaining it being within the terminal boundary. While most of the research team were unaffected by the expansion of the terminality field, Dr. Cheryl Andrews was observing the startup on Deck 3. Reports from staff assigned to her indicate that she dismissed the team to another observation point shortly before the start of the Delta 2 trial. One of the researchers, Haroldson, returned to the chamber to speak with her and only managed to survive the terminal incursion due to him standing right on the edge of the boundary at the moment the void manifested. The boundary intersected with spacetime at a point roughly 3 centimeters into Haroldson's right side, causing a significant section of his right arm and leg to collapse into the point plane. The remainder of his body was ejected by the shock of the compulsion force, and nearby personnel were able to get him moved to the on-site infirmary. Dr. Andrews was caught entirely within the terminal boundary and is believed to have been instantly killed. We next move on to some info about Point Horizon, a Foundation meta-technology initiative assigned to Foundation European Command. It was created in 2007, dissolved in 2015, and was afterwards wholly folded into the Deepwell 354 site terminus, which replaced it. It was originally established by Cormaxon and Zatsepin, researchers who had unknowingly worked alongside the 3930 team during initial surveillance testing of that anomaly as early as 1995. After being made aware of the metaphysical characteristics of 3930, and after additional information gained from working alongside Dr. Robert Scranton before his death, the two worked to devise a theorem regarding meta-quantum tunneling and the nature of unreality. In short, their model suggests that the universal understanding of reality is a metaphysical truth necessitating an underlying layer of unreality, or that which is requiring a that which is not. In their model, unreality exists as a framework surrounding every instance of real, and that it's the scaffolding beneath which reality itself is constructed. The unreal informs the real, as all things that will at once be real must first be derived from the unreal. Shortly after publishing their conceptualization of reality and unreality, the two were approached by Foundation Director of Advanced Metatechnology, Dr. Arthur Ball, and the three began working with Ball's team to create the first prototype of what would eventually become the Charna containment vessel. Cormaxon and Zatsepin were eventually joined by other former members of the 3930 research team, many of whom had been eligible for amnestic treatment and reassignment, but still held expertise in high-level relativistic metaphysics. One of these researchers was Dr. Cheryl Andrews, who originally proposed what would eventually become the Point Horizon Initiative during a May 2007 meeting between herself, Cormaxon, Zatsepin, and Dr. Harry Leclerc, a senior engineer on Ball's team. We're given a transcript of that meeting. Andrews says that the field Zatsepin is proposing might not just be enough to sustain a firm threshold of dire reality around the anomaly, it may even be enough to sustain incursions into it as well. The power needed to sustain the field scales up past reasonable limits inside the terminal border, but a probe fitted with these things would be small enough that the draw might be within practical boundaries. Just millimeters of incursion at the max, but enough for them to get some instruments in there and see what's on the other side. The void itself can be tiny, only a few microns across. Zatsepin counters that they know what's on the other side, as it's nothing, but But Andrew says that it's not just nothing, though. This is the narrative bedrock, the absolute most foundational element of all of existence. Maybe there's nothing they can see straight away, but that's just an issue of calibration. Once they prove that they can make the incursion in the first place, they can keep taking readings until they find something. Cormac then remarks that even if they're able to keep the power draw reasonable, they're still talking about billions of euros in expenses. If they really do just turn up nothing, they'll be answering to finance for it. They might not even make groundbreak unless they're able to provide a timeline for some kind of result. The Foundation just doesn't do speculative research on this scale. That's assuming the generators work as well. The math is consistent, but there are supply chain issues to address, as even the adjusted figures still call for half the planet's total yearly supply of scandium. Andrews understands that, but there has to be a way for them to convince European Command about the value of this project. They haven't hesitated to fund metaphysical initiatives before, even those with way fewer potential upsides than this. Even Talaran got his budget. Cormac encounters that there's a magnitude of difference there, as they're just barely into prototyping and talking about 3 billion euros at the low end. Leclerc chimes in to say that it would be tough to justify, but not impossible. He knows that there has been money allocated for containing 3930, and he knows that most of that money has gone unspent. He doesn't know where it's being held currently, or if there's been any talk of doing anything with it other than maintaining an indefinite perimeter in the snow, but it's possible they could reason a way to justify reallocating that money towards this project, with the understanding that they'd have to get involved with the group running that team as well. Cormaxin, however, says that that might be an issue, as that team reports up through European, but there are special tie-ins to the O5s embedded in it. They've got liaisons all over that project, and have for years. Something about one of the overseers having a specific interest in that thing. Getting in bed with Overwatch isn't ideal, but the alternative is this thing dying in the crib. If they can get someone senior like Dr. Ball involved, they may be able to mitigate most of the upper room meddling. Cormaxin asks Leclerc if Ball would be up for it, to which he says that it depends on the proposal. The others think that the proposal is feasible, so they decide to move forward with it. We're next given a collection of notes and correspondence written by or to Dr. Andrews regarding Point Horizon or SCP-7341, starting with a couple of excerpts from a collection of notes titled "The Practicality of Observing the Unreal." It is expected, then, that interaction with the unreal would be an otherwise practical impossibility. Intersection between reality and unreality inevitably favors unreality, and attempting to cross a point of unreality is, in essence, the purest form of obliteration. There is no matter that is left over afterwards, no energy that propagates out from that point of contact. The thing that intersects simply ceases to be, with no lingering trace that it was ever there at all. Thus, any equipment designed to interact with the unreal must be in some way insulated from the void, in a way that does not cause its immediate obliteration. Assuming this is possible, as Dr. Zatsepin's model suggests it may be, what is the end result for the instrument in question? Would it not only receive incoming data from the insulation of reality around itself? The essence of the void is an absence of any and all information. Information does not originate or propagate across a void, and therefore any tool used to gather that information would be useless. And yet, we know by comparison with the real that there must be some kind of information exchange within a void. If we are able to determine truths about what is real, then its inverse must exist. It is likely that, while we as real creatures are incapable of perception outside of our limited understanding of reality, there exists a language the void speaks that we simply cannot understand. I'm not yet convinced that the void is some great unknowable, despite how obvious an answer that might be. Dr. Scranton believed it was in some way a great repository of knowledge that the real uses as a form of reference. Existence has to check against what is not real in order to determine what is real, and there is clearly a defined boundary between the two. Where else in nature do such boundaries exist in such a determined form? Even at our most fundamental scale, we are composed of elements and atoms and subparticles, all of which themselves are nebulous and interact freely with each other, but the void and the material maintain a strict demarcation. Why is this, if not an intentional aspect of their utility towards each other? If I were given to supposition, I would speculate that the unreal, being far greater in size than all of reality by an unknowable factor, somehow uses reality as a playground. Not knowingly, perhaps, but there is clear intention in what is funneled out from unreality into reality. There is purpose here. There must be purpose. The fact that the void can intersect with our reality at all is proof enough of its existence, or non-existence, as it were. But that intersection itself must have a reason. In an email to Andrews from Cormexin, he says that he agrees with her hypothesis on the metallurgical challenges, but thinks that the scandium alloy that Leclerc's team is working on resolves a lot of those concerns. They'll need to schedule a new set of tests in the simulator to try and see what their new limits are, and then redo the calculations once they're confident of the results. He also states that he doesn't want to get too personal, but he saw where she'd canceled her time off next week and asks if everything is all right. They've been pushing pretty hard the last few months, so getting some time to relax might do her and the rest of them some good. She replies that the scandium alloy can't come soon enough, and getting away from yttrium is going to really help their weight issues too. She says that she's all right, she's just been working pretty well recently and doesn't want to lose momentum. They're getting really close to something important here, and she thinks if they keep pushing at it, they're going to have a breakthrough really soon. She also tells him not to be weird, as she's been more personal with him than anyone else in the last 3 years. If she's comfortable enough letting him see the small mountain of pizza boxes in her apartment, and other things, she's comfortable enough talking about her time off allocation. Cormaxin replies that he's glad to hear it, and says that this is still pretty new for him, so he didn't want to overstep. If it hadn't been next month, he wouldn't have bothered, but the timing with going to see her mom just felt weird. If she says that she's good though, he'll leave it alone. She replies that it's really okay, as her mom isn't going anywhere anytime soon. A date is just a date. If he's that worried, she'll look at her schedule sometime in April and maybe they can go somewhere on the continent. Reykjavik is nice, but she thinks that she's reached her lifetime's allotment of fish and brown bread. Cormaxin suggests a house on a lake in Scotland that his parents' friend has, as it's been a good place if he needed to clear his head. And she says that she'll let him know what she thinks. In a collection of untitled notes, one reads, "I had another dream last night, just like all the others. I'm standing in the library, and she's on the other side of the racks. I keep looking for ways to get across to her, but the paths just loop back to where I can see her. It's just her eyes looking back at me. I can't tell if she's smiling or crying or anything. She's just there. But because she's that, means she's somewhere, and I'm just not trying hard enough to get to where she's at. I don't think this is an accident. My subconscious has got to be telling me something. Maybe I've been looking at this all wrong the whole time." Another reads, "What about reflections? Not visual reflections, but relativistic ones. We can't push anything real into anything unreal because that unmakes it. If we have the thing we're pushing wrapped in a causal field, we can protect it from unreality, but we get feedback from the field itself. If it's compensating for higher or lower unrelativistic feedback, we're getting some information from that, like poking around with a needle in the dark. do it enough times and keep track of what feedback you get when you run into an obstacle, and you can start to make out the shape of something you can't see. Why can't we do the same? Biggest problem is instrumentation, again. Using the probes we'd need, we'll need an access point probably 3 or 4 times bigger than what we'd been planning. Harry is going to hate it, but we won't be able to get what we need without it. We're not going to have time to change Beta either, so we're going to need to push it to Delta. Note to self: talk to John in the morning about reflections. Talk to Harry about energy scaling. In an email reply to Andrews from Leclerc about power allocation for refined point void vectors, he swears and says that she needs to start warning him about these emails. The initial Point Horizon test run was conducted between April and September of 2011. The first test series was intended to show a proof of concept of the metastability of the Charna containment vessel when exposed to a point void terminality field. The vessel was not yet configured to contain the field in question, so the point void was intentionally unstable and collapsed between 45 and 72 nanoseconds after its genesis. Despite this, the test duration was sufficient to induce the internal load on the prototype Charna vessel. Cormaxin describes the result of the test to European Command by saying that the shock of the terminality field was outside of expected parameters and managed to flatten everything in a 2.3-meter sphere around the containment vessel, but Charna was recovered undamaged. Evaluation of the vessel revealed what they expected, with higher than baseline metaphysical stability, more than sufficient enough to reduce the radius of the same field by at least 40%. If they're able to get that reduction up to 43%, which Zatsepin believes is within reason, they'll be able to reduce the overall outer containment vessel by 15% of its current size. It should then easily fit within any of the Tier 3 Deepwell sites. The second test run of Point Horizon was a series of tests conducted between December of 2012 and July of 2015. This series was intended to show the functional stability of the Visca generator array in maintaining the terminality field, and the array was comprised of 72 amplified di-reality field generator heads surrounding the Charna vessel. A secondary function of the test was to show the viability of Andrew's relativistic reflection theory by introducing a Millihume wave sensor probe into the manifested anomaly prior to its collapse, to ascertain both whether or not the probe could survive the incursion across the terminal boundary, and if any information could be ascertained about the void as a result of increased feedback compensation on the part of Cleo. We're getting into admonition level of technobabble here, but basically they want to send a probe into the nothingness to see what happens. Andrews summarizes the results afterwards by saying that the array and vessel met their performance expectations, and the point void was sustained for a period of 3 minutes and 15 seconds. Considering that the test ran well below Cleo's operational limit, it's reasonable to presume that a scale-up test using the same configuration is within reach. During the test period, a shielded probe was inserted past the terminal boundary and into the point void for a period of 10 seconds. Variations in the Cleo's feedback compensation was measured and charted, showing minor variation that they're currently attributing to noise. However, they did verify that they are capable of pushing a probe into the point void and retrieving it. They have conducted numerous double-blind tests on the probe and have confirmed that it still exists, confirming their initial hypothesis. They're now preparing a scaled-up version of the test, and she'll be submitting a request for a larger probe test run. They're on the verge of peering into the last great unknown, and everything beyond this point is instrumentation. In another collection of emails between Andrews and Cormaxin, Cormaxin writes that he noticed she never booked that trip back to the States to see her mom, and wonders if everything is all right. Since they've got time now between test 2 and 3, he figured this would be the perfect time for them to go. Andrews replies that she's been super busy, and she'll try to get it scheduled sometime in the next few months. She asks if he's spoken to Ball about pushing the probe test up from test 4 to 3. She hasn't heard back from him since the first of the year. Cormaxin replies that he hasn't, but she knows what he's going to say. The scale-up is just for conditional testing. New implementation is set for 4, and everything afterwards has to wait until the Deepwell site is running. He asks if she's sure about the trip, as it's really no big deal, and they can take the time if she wants. Andrews just asks how he can be okay with that, as they have to push everything they've been working on for the last 4 years into next year because European wants to sit on their hands. They can do the exact same work with Clio as they can with Visca, and they won't have to wait another 5 years to do it. She asks if there's something else going on here, but Cormaxin just tells her not to shoot the messenger. All he knows is that the success of Beta 1 and 2 have accelerated the Deepwell timeline. That's a good thing, as it means they're going to have funding for the next 30 years, among other things. They're all going to continue to have jobs, so he figured she'd be happy about that. She says that none of that matters if they aren't able to show proof of concept on the probe tests. The whole point of this was for them to see what's on the other side of this thing, so if they get to Deepwell and the probes are still returning generator noise, then what? They've wasted billions of dollars on a preposterously elaborate paperweight. Cormaxin replies that calling the sum of 1,000 people's efforts to create the first stable manufactured point void array a paperweight is kind of dismissive. They're still doing science here. It's not like they just dismissed the probe tests out of hand. If they get to Deepwell and they have issues, then they'll just adjust and move forward. The fact that they're building Visca at all means that they're committed to this thing. Andrews asks if the probe tests aren't the priority, then what exactly are they committed to? Cormaxin doesn't know what she means, and then doesn't get a response. We're then given another untitled note from Andrews, which reads, "I heard something." There's this phenomenon called the cocktail party effect. It's the sudden awareness you achieve when you hear something familiar mixed in with a lot of other noise, like hearing someone say your name at a cocktail party. You hear something you've become so intimately familiar with over the course of your entire life, and in that moment your brain zeroes in on it. I've analyzed the recording over and over again for months and come up with nothing quantifiable. But during Beta 2, I heard something. I cannot deny it. I know I heard it because I've heard it 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times. I hear it when I think of my childhood, the time I spent with my brothers in the forest back home when the sun was setting and the chill rolled over the hills. I hear it when I think of late night phone calls for no reason, of the distance that was like a vice around my throat feeling suddenly so small, even for just a moment. I hear it when I think of hospitals, and crosswords, and watching soaps on a TV that is too small. I hear it when I think of absent words and gravesides, and photos taken off of walls. I hear it even now, sitting here writing this, when I think of the nights spent studying with a reassuring cup of tea, and a smile that would turn my insecurities to ash. I hear it after 3 soft knocks on the door, to let me know she was there. It was my mother's voice. It cannot have been anything else. I don't think what we're trying to do here is so outlandish. We conjure things out of the immaterial every single day, in stories and songs and dreams, things that did not exist before we brought them into being. They all had to come from somewhere, and now we know with some certainty where that is. If we can take the immaterial and make it material, in all the ways we share that which once was not, then who is to say we can't get more out of the nothingness than just songs and stories? The 4th and final test run of the Beta series was a test conducted after the scale-up test in Beta 3, and the final test that used the Clio Die Reality Generator Array prior to the implementation of the Visca Array at Deepwell 354. Due to time and personnel restraints necessitated by the reorganization of Point Horizon into Deepwell 354, the test was conducted almost single-handedly by Andrews and Zatsepin. The test was overall a repeat of the Beta 3 test, with a single exception. Andrews had been developing an improved Millihume wave sensor probe to provide more accurate feedback from the generated point void. The result of this test was inconclusive. After a bit more technobabble between Zatsepin and Andrews as the test begins, Andrews says that they could increase the inhibitor's voltage in order to form the void. Zatsepin says that there's a containment risk, but Andrews insists in order to avoid scrapping the test. The void forms, but Zatsepin remarks that there's lots of noise in here, so they need to bring the inhibitor down. Andrews counters that if they bring the inhibitor down now, they may lose the void, so they can filter the noise later. Andrews insists on continuing the test, despite the high level of noise, until Zatsepin says that speaking as her friend and colleague, he's seriously considering stopping the test. This is all highly irregular. They need to back the inhibitors off, and they need to let Cleo stabilize. None of the data they're going to get is going to be usable. Andrews insists that they just need to see a spike, but he says that she doesn't have any idea what that might look like. If the spike she's looking for is within the noise boundary, then it'll get filtered out, and she may not even know what she's looking at. Andrews says that she understands, but they can't risk a void collapse, so they have to do this now. Zatsepin asks, or else what? They'll have to do the test again when Visca is running? Andrews doesn't reply, but says that the generators are cooling, so they can proceed with the probe test. She proceeds, and Zatsepin relents, so they insert the probe into the void. Zatsepin notes that they're getting some asymmetry on the terminal boundary because of the inhibitor, so they need to back it off now. Andrews insists on needing more time as multiple alarms begin to sound. Zatsepin tells her that the void is going to destabilize if they don't pull the inhibitor off right now, but Andrews ignores him, instead asking if someone is there, and if they can hear her. Zatsepin begins to ask who she's talking to, but then announces that they're getting generator overload warnings, and they're about to lose containment. Andrews swears at him and tells him to compensate for the inhibitor draw, but he pulls the inhibitors regardless. Andrews says that they're losing the void, and he tells her that they're about to lose the station if they don't push the generators in and collapse it. Andrews relents and pushes the generators in, but then another critical alarm is heard, warning of impending void collapse. Another sound is then heard, as the feedback compensators activate momentarily, and they realize that it's the probe. They finally collapse the void and finish the test. Zatsepin then points to the feedback log, where a massive spike is seen. Andrews asks if that's from the collapse, but it was from 15 seconds beforehand. Zatsepin acknowledges that he thinks she was right. At the conclusion of the Beta 4 test, a full damage assessment of the prototype Charna vessel and Cleo array was conducted. The vessel was fully destroyed, partially by proximity to the unchecked terminal boundary during the runaway asymmetry caused by improper application of the wavepoint inhibitor, and partially by the uncompensated shockwave resulting from a point void collapse. Fragments of the vessel were found embedded into many of Cleo's generator heads, effectively totaling the array. Andrews was found to have inappropriately accelerated the array startup sequence, which left the system in an improperly configured state. Cleo was unable to compensate for the asymmetry, leading to the destruction of the array. The silver lining of this was that the data regarding this asymmetry allowed the AI to later compensate for improper energy allocation during the Delta 2 test, maintaining proper containment of 7341. Andrews was brought before the Foundation Disciplinary Committee, who found that while it would be a misuse of resources to remove her from the project entirely, her actions were not befitting of a doctor of the Foundation. As a result, she was placed on suspended leave for a period of 1 year, during which time she was held under house arrest by Foundation security forces. While under house arrest, she continued to receive correspondence from the Deepwell 354 team, in order to facilitate the ongoing success of the project. We're given a recorded phone call between Andrews and Cormaxon shortly after the beginning of her suspension period. She says that she's doing all right, and they've got someone who comes and washes her clothes now, which is an improvement over the first few days. Other than that, she's good, as she's got her stuff and her computer. They want her to keep working, which is a blessing, she guesses, as she'd rather have something to do than just sit around here. She calls it jail, as she's not allowed to leave, but it's fine, as she gets to sleep in her own bed and gets to work. Cormax encounters that she did very nearly void out half the site, but she snaps that they didn't, though. She apologizes, and says that given the circumstances, she should be grateful it's not worse. She asks if he's spoken to Zatseppin about what happened, and he did. He listened to the site recording as well, and he asks her to help him make this make sense. She knew that keeping the inhibitors in like that could cause the field to get unbalanced, and then when it did, she didn't do anything they know to do in case of asymmetry. And then Zatseppin says that she was calling out to someone while the boundary was pushing up on the edge of the vessel. Andrews doesn't respond, and Cormaxon says that he called her brother, who was surprised to hear from him, and said that the two of them haven't spoken in a long time. He asks when she was going to tell him about her mom. I'll read this section verbatim for clarity. She was so happy when I got selected. She was always so kind and supportive of all of us. When I went off to school, she called me every single day, and when I was studying for the Skipats, she had me move back in with her and my dad so she could take care of everything while I was working. When I left, I know it broke her heart. She would never say it, but I could tell. When you hear something every single day for years, even the slightest difference becomes noticeable immediately, and I noticed. When she got sick, my brothers basically moved in with her. They took care of her every single day for years. Dad couldn't do it on his own, you know, so they were there, and it took me 6 months to get back there, and by the time I did, she was just barely there. But she still called, you know. Not every night, but as often as she could. Whenever she was strong enough to do it. She'd have Dad hold the receiver, and she'd just talk into it, and we'd talk about what was on TV or what was for lunch that day. I slept on the couch in her room every day for a month. To think I would complain about my laundry situation now, it was bad then. Dad would come in and practically force me into his car so I could go take a shower at their place. She used to do this thing where she'd knock 3 times on my door when I was studying just to let me know she was there if I needed anything. And she started doing it when she needed to sit up, because sometimes she couldn't talk very well. One day she says, "It means I love you." It was only a month, but it could have been 15 minutes. It went by so fast. She called me the night before it happened. They had me come back up here just for the start of the Alpha trials, and I told her I'd call her every day, and then that day I didn't, but she still tried to call me. Dad said she was adamant about it, said I must have dozed off. But I was in the lab, had been all night. I didn't even check my phone when I got back to my apartment. I went straight to bed, and then the next day, John, I never got to tell her I loved her. Cormaxon asks if she thinks her mom didn't know that, and Andrews says that she doesn't know, but she just can't stop thinking of her laying there, waiting for her to call back. All of this, everything they're doing here, it all has to mean something. Maybe there's no rhyme or reason to any of this, to life, to existence, but they aren't just drawing pictures on cave walls anymore. They've looked over to the other side. Cormaxon remarks that they're saying the probe feedback was caused by the field instability, but Andrews calls that bullshit. She sat there and watched it the whole time. It was working, and it never stopped working until the very end. Something on the other side saw them. Something pushed back. She asks if he knows what that means, but he just says that he knows what she probably thinks it means. Zatseppin seems to think she's onto something, and the fact that they got any feedback at all is a breakthrough all on its own, if it is actually feedback and not just the probe responding to void collapse. But she has no idea what it is that caused the probe feedback, or if it even was an it at all. She's talking about metaphysical unreality in there. It's not like just a dreamland where everyone goes when they die. That's the unreal. They haven't even begun to figure out what this could even mean, and she could have gotten hurt. Andrews pauses before saying that she doesn't know how she can tell him this in a way that makes any sense, but she just knows that it was her. There's a world out there where her mother doesn't die while she's sitting in her office going over materials reports. She knows that it's in there because that world doesn't exist right now. That's what they're talking about. What's real and what isn't. Cormaxon says that he's sorry for what happened to her mom, and he cannot pretend to know how that felt, but he doesn't know if what she wants is possible. What she's talking about is the fundamental force in the universe. He doesn't believe that's within their reach, but she disagrees. We then see a notice of reassignment orders to go into effect at the conclusion of the Delta test series, with all of the team, including Andrews, to be reassigned to different sites. Cormaxon and Leclerc, however, will stay on at Deepwell 354. Shortly after this memorandum was distributed, Zatseppin sent an email to Cormaxon, reading, "John, I have never sought your approval, and out of respect for your station, I do not intend to begin now. When I initially heard about this personnel reassignment order, I had hoped it was an unfortunate bit of office drama that would resolve itself. I recognize now this is not the case. I had likewise hoped he would show more spine in the face of pressure from Overwatch, but I seemingly judged you too fairly. Let me tell you something you already know. The thing we have built here is a danger beyond dangers. We have been able to encapsulate it at times, yes, but this project stands on the absolute razor's edge, and always has. It is through the efforts of a dedicated team of some of the most brilliant scientists I have ever met that we have managed to contain the annihilating power therein for so long, and to presume that you will be able to do so without them is madness. And for what, John? So an overseer can turn this site into their plaything? To give them something they can gaze into and wax poetic? To cast them all aside and allow these interests to infiltrate what we have worked so desperately to create is an act of paramount disrespect. I hope, at the very least, for the sake of whatever you once shared with her, that you let Cheryl know in person instead of through an email. Cheers, Ivan." The Delta test series began on the 4th of October 2021, and while multiple tests were originally scheduled, only two tests took place. On the 21st of December, during Mercahui's startup phase, a change was made to the energy allocation logic by an undetermined user. The change was made at the terminal level, and therefore did not require user authentication, although the user would have required extensive knowledge of the AI's base intelligence layer. Only four members of the senior leadership would have been familiar with these systems: Cormaxon, Leclerc, Gantry, and Andrews. Such changes normally require a handshake from the AI's logic evaluator, but the change was submitted in a 3-second window during which this evaluator was being cycled as part of the startup phase. The AI did initially identify and flag the change to its energy allocation logic, but this flag was marked non-critical and was not reviewed by the site administrator, Cormaxon, prior to the activation of the wave point inhibitor. The flag was only noticed as the Visca array was coming online, at which point there was a 7-second window during which the test could have been cancelled, but Cormaxin neglected to shutter the array in time. At the moment of point void formation, the terminal boundary expanded beyond the vessel as a result of the limited power resources available to the array at the time. The AI immediately maximized the available power draw to the array, which halted the boundary expansion at its current position within the Level 3 observation deck. Despite the catastrophic breach of containment, the AI identified the point void formation and relative stability of the array and automatically began the test cycle. The test probe developed by Andrews was energized and inserted into the void. While the test was cancelled shortly afterwards, the probe remains locked in place. We're given one more note from Andrews, from a collection titled, To Suppose What Is Real. It reads, There are two definite states in creation, the things that exist and the things that do not. Beyond that, there are those things that are physical, those that are made whole out of the matter of the universe, and there are those things that are immaterial, the thoughts, dreams, and stories of the physical. It is the latter that we often consider to be the unreal, as we cannot reach out and touch them, we cannot see them with waking eyes. They exist in as many universes as there are those who imagine them, and they are as innumerable as they are fleeting. But these immaterial things are not the unreal. A child's dream of what sort of hero they may grow up to be is not something you can neatly organize, certainly, but that does not mean it is not real. The immaterium is a boundary way between what is and what is not, and therefore exists as an intermediary between the two, what could be. These fleeting hopes and ambitions are, in many ways, the stencil by which the unreal becomes the real, the inspiration from which the art of creation is drawn upon the canvas of reality. We presume that the physical and the immaterial are altogether two different things, but they simply are not, nor can they be. A desperate mother hoping for another day, a wounded soldier dreaming of home, a storyteller turning memory into immortality. These are the simple acts that we, every single day, partake in, which shape the very most base fabric of our existence. In this way, we become not just an observer of the canvas of God, but the hand behind the brushstroke. If, then, we suppose that the unreal is not so foreign to us, and our ability to shape it not so limited, where is the limit of that power? How can we be satisfied to watch the hand move and not alter its course? I have heard some say that the limit of man should be at the doorstep of God, that we cannot cross that threshold into remaking the universe in our design. I would argue that this is a ludicrous notion. We do it every day. And if we are able to remake the universe, which should be clear now is within our grasp, then everything beyond this point is instrumentation. The length and depth of the brushstroke, the coarseness of the fibers, the subtlety of the palette. When we gaze into the heart of oblivion, we are not giving ourselves to annihilation. We are asking the universe a question. We are looking at what is real and asking what is possible. In a sense, we are coming home. Home to where our spirit calls us, home to that which most satisfies our soul. The void may seem like nothing. In truth, it is everything. We have only to reach out and touch the brush. Ours are the hands of God. The universe is the canvas. The unreal is the paint. We are the artists. Lastly, we're given an addendum stating that on October 23rd, 2024, the AI identified a moment of relativistic feedback through the Millihume wave sensor probe locked in place within the void. This feedback moment corresponded with an increase in incidents involving personnel stationed near the terminality boundary experiencing auditory hallucinations. The source of these hallucinations could not be determined. Analysis of this data has been inconclusive. No additional feedback had been registered prior to this incident, and no feedback has been registered since. The feedback log shows 3 small spikes in a row. So, Andrews experienced a lot of guilt and pain over her mother passing and not being there to say goodbye. She became convinced that she could manifest the unreal into the real, manifest a reality where her mother didn't die while she's sitting in her office going over reports. On the one hand, we know that these voids contain absolutely nothing, and people merely fill the gaps in their brains with what they think should be there. On the other hand, the tests done did seem to prove that something can be discerned from nothingness. I'll admit that a lot of this goes over my head, but it would seem based on the final addendum that there is something going on beyond the void. The 3 spikes in the log seem indicative of the 3 knocks that Andrew's mother used to do, meaning, I love you. I'm sure that the Foundation doesn't know much of anything about what's beyond the void, sort of like what's within a black hole, but Andrews believed in the idea enough to throw herself into it. Perhaps she was right, or perhaps if you gaze long enough into a void, the void will gaze back at you.